Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Sort of the little before class, I'm allowed to talk politics. During class, so we don't do that.
For sure.
But, yeah. Okay, it's not even politics; it's ethics and morality. But okay, that's all a subject. Anyways, Erev Tov, everybody. Tzoraim Tovim, depending on where you are. A pleasure to welcome back Dr. Lakshin. It's been a few months, and please God, we'll have the pleasure of hearing him as we head into the summer session after Pesach. Really, he needs no introduction. As you heard, he made Aliyah 7.5 years ago and subscribes to Haaretz. Used to subscribe to Haaretz. But Dr. Lakshin,
what else there to say?
the things people don't know about you. Everybody knows you were a longtime professor at York University. Maybe people don't know you learned in Merkaz Harav for 4 years. That I don't know that everybody knows, and that you're graduated from you know Brandeis, but that you're an expert on Rashbam and Al Parshanut, I think people do know. And we're friends, of course, from your days in Toronto, and happier and very well adjusted in Israel. And Baruch Hashem, nice to see you. And without further ado, Dr. Lakshin, Vakasha did an error me and really tried to destroy my father, as you can all see. Okay, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman, and wonderful to see you all, those of you who are related to me and those who are not related to me. All of you, I'm happy to see. At this time, a week from now, those of us here in Israel are going to be sitting down to our Seder, and we are going to be saying that an Aramean did try to destroy our father. Those of you who are in North America, you have a week and 7 hours until you'll get a chance to say these words. And these words are an interpretation of a biblical text. And we'll begin the session today by just looking at the biblical text. So here we are. I'll read it in English, and anybody who can read the Hebrew can follow along in the Hebrew. When you enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a heritage, and you possess it and you settle in it, you shall take some of every first fruit of the soil which you harvest from the land that the Lord your God is giving you, put it in a basket, and go to the place where the Lord your God will choose to establish his name. You shall go to the priest in charge at the time and say to him, I acknowledge this day before the Lord your God that I have entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign to us. The priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down in front of the altar of the Lord your God. So what we have here is the Bikurim ceremony of the Israelite farmer coming to Jerusalem with the first fruits, presenting them in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, handing them to the priest who puts them down before the altar. And then the first thing that the farmer, this Ole LaRegel, this pilgrim, is supposed to say, I acknowledge this day before the Lord your God that I have entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. So we'll get back to that line. And then, after this, the pilgrim is supposed to recite a further formula. You shall then recite as follows before the Lord your God. And I didn't translate those three words there. I didn't do it because that is the whole question of how to translate those three words there. Arami Oved Avi. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there, but there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea, and he saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm, an awesome power, and by signs and portents, he brought us to this place, and he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Wherefore, I now bring the first fruits of the soil which you, O Lord, have given me. And that's the end of the speech. This speech, as everybody here surely knows, became the central text for the Seder. We go through this text, beginning with the words Arami Oved Avi, down to ויוציאנו השם ממצרים ביד חזקה ובצרור נצויה ומורה גדול ואותות ומופתים. That's where we, and we explain each phrase, and that's the center of the Haggadah. And there's quite a long literature about why this text was specifically chosen to be the center of the Haggadah. Why don't we read the beginning of the book of Exodus? There are other things that we could have chosen. And there are many explanations about why this specific text was chosen to be the center of the Haggadah. One possibility, though, is that people knew it by heart, because pilgrims who came every year to the Beit HaMikdash with their first fruits, with the Bikurim, would have memorized these texts. And so when we sit down at the Seder, we can recite this text that everybody knows, and we can give an exposition of what this text means. So that's one possibility of what we are doing. So in order to understand what Arami Obeid Avi actually means, what those three words mean, I guess the one of the first questions that someone who's trying to understand a text asks is, what interpretation fits best into the context? And there are two ways of understanding the context of what is going on in this speech that's given by the Israelite pilgrim. Is this a text about persecution and freedom, or is it a text about land and no land? So, like, to go back to the previous slides, you can see the contextual explanation here of saying that this the major theme here is the theme of gratitude for having the land. I acknowledge here. Higadti hayom l'Hashem Elokecha ki bati el ha'aretz asher nishba Hashem l'avotenu l'atet lanu. I'm here in this land. And this wasn't always our land. We were down there in Egypt with meager numbers, and then God took us out of Egypt, and God brought us from Egypt to this land. You know, we can't quite prove this, but it's possible that the last verses here of this text here, by the Enu Alamakom Hazeh, Vayiten Lanu Et Haaretz Hazot, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, that God brought us to this place. It's possible that when Pesach was observed here in Eretz Yisrael 2,000 years ago, and when the Mishnah tells us that the Magid of the Seder should be based on an exposition of this text that says, "V'doresh me Arami Obeid Avi ad shegomer kol ha'parasha kula," from Arami Obeid Avi to the end of the section here. So presumably they also explained that last verse, "Vayivienu el ha'makom hazeh v'yitin lanu et ha'aretz hazot." And since for the majority of Jewish history, Jews have lived, the grand majority of Jews have been living outside of Eretz Yisrael, it was difficult for people living in Babylonia or in Poland or in Yemen or in Germany or in Canada to say the words "Vayivienu el ha'makom hazeh," because they weren't in that makom. But it's possible that that was part of the original exposition of the text. And so you might say that the context here is a context of there was a time when we didn't have any land, and now we have land. And that is kind of the standard scholarly understanding of Arami Obeid Avi, which is that it means my father was a wandering Aramean. And that fits into the context of land or no land. That we say here, now we're here in the land. And then we recite, you know, back in the old day, I'm descended from somebody who was a wandering Aramean. And then after being a wandering Aramean, the people went down to Egypt. And then finally they were brought to this land. He brought us to this place. He gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And that's why I brought these first fruits here to the Beit HaMikdash. So that is one of the ways of understanding this text. And as I said, it's the common scholarly way of understanding this text. If you open up pretty well any English translation, unless it is done by somebody who's decided that they're going to be translating it in a way that will conform to the Haggadah, generally it's translated as, my father was a wandering Aramean. The other possibility of what the context here is that it's a text about persecution and freedom. And clearly, here in the text in Devarim, there is persecution. He went down to Egypt. He sojourned there. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us. Vayanunu, vayidnu aldeinu avodah kasha. And then we called out to God. And so the possibility of saying that Arami Oved Avi is beginning the theme of persecution, which will be solved through God's intervention. And then Arami Oved Avi would reasonably mean that an Aramean wanted to destroy my father. So those are the two possibilities of contextual understandings of what is going on here. So just for everybody, to remind everybody what the Haggadah does with it, it wasn't just one person who stood up against us to destroy us. Lo echad bilvad amad aleinu l'chaloteinu, ela shebechol dor vador omnim aleinu l'chaloteinu, v'akadosh baruch hu matzilenu miyadam. God saves us from those who try to destroy us, and they try to destroy us in every generation. And then the Haggadah will bolster this with the words Arami Oved Avi. Don't think that it was just Pharaoh. Actually, there were worse than Pharaoh. We're here at the Seder in order to remember what Pharaoh wanted to do with us, but let's remember that there was somebody who was worse than Pharaoh, and that was Lavan the Aramean, who wanted to destroy everything. As it is written, an Aramean would have destroyed my father. That's how Professor Nachum Glatzer, who taught at Brandeis University, he actually retired a year or two before I became a student at Brandeis, but I feel in many ways that I'm a
Carol,
student
you want to take Thomas?
From his books and from being a student of his students. So it's hard to say that the text means that those three Hebrew words, Arami, Oved, Avi, means an Aramean destroyed my father. So you just have to kind of turn it into a subjunctive or something like this, would have destroyed my father. But then he went down to Egypt. So that's the traditional understanding that we will all read at the Seder next Wednesday. For those who are interested in these questions and seeing how the oldest translations of the Bible understood this phrase, so the Septuagint reads, "My father abandoned Syria, left Syria," which I guess is an understanding of like being a wandering Syrian. But Syria is more or less where Aram is, and so my father was a Syrian who left Syria, and then he went down to Egypt. So this is the oldest translation of the Bible into any language. It's the Greek translation of the Bible, written by Jews in Alexandria about 2,200 years ago. I'm sure that all or almost all of you know the Jewish legend that King Ptolemy was interested in reading the Bible and asked the Jews if they would be so kind as to translate it into Greek so that he'd be able to read it. But he didn't trust the Jews that they would translate it accurately. So he gathered 70 scholars together and he sat them in 70 cubicles and asked each of them to do the work on his own. And then miraculously, they all came up with the same translation. Most of the scholars today suggest that probably the translation was made not for King Ptolemy, or not just for King Ptolemy. It was made for the fact that there were a lot of Jews living in Alexandria who couldn't read the Bible in Hebrew anymore. In the same way that the major reason why the Jewish Publication Society or the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zichron Livracha, wrote translations of the Bible into English in order to make it more available to English speaking Jews. So this might have been a translation that was made by educated Jews 2,200 years ago who were trying to suggest that is the meaning of the text here. It's the land or no land theme of the text. When we get to skip down to the bottom one here, Targum Onklos here, a translation, the oldest rabbinic translation of the Bible into Aramaic, which probably also was done because there were many Jews who read Aramaic and couldn't handle the Hebrew very well. So here's the Aramaic translation. Lavan arama'a be'a la'abada yataba. Laban the Aramaean sought to or wanted to destroy my father. A few years after that, the Bible is translated by Christians into Latin, and in the Latin translation we have here, the Syrian pursued my father who went down into Egypt. That looks like close to the Jewish, the understanding of the Haggadah. That Latin verb there, persequebater, it looks like the word persecute. It really is connected to the verb that means to follow, you know, like sequel in English comes from this Latin verb that means to follow, and sequere means to follow, and per sequere means to follow with some kind of negative intention, to intensely follow or something like that. It was chased after my father. So that could be what the text here is suggesting. So it would seem that the Christians who we know consulted with Jews when they translated the Bible into Latin, they came up with a translation that is pretty similar to what we say in the Haggadah. The translation that we, the understanding of the Haggadah is not surprisingly the understanding of Rashi, who writes in his commentary on this verse, Mazkir Chazbei Hamakom. What is the theme here? The theme is praising God for saving us from those who have attempted to destroy us. Arami Oved Avi, Lavan Bikesh La'akor et HaKol K'sheradaf Achar Yaakov. When Lavan chased after Yaakov, his intention was to uproot or annihilate everything. And then, you know, one of the problems with this interpretation, if you look back at the text, like that jump from Aramil Vedavi, to the next line, he went down to Egypt, is not the smoothest jump. So Rashi says here, the theme is people oppressing the Jews, people persecuting the Jews, and that the first persecutor is Laban, and the second one is the Egyptians. And there were others who tried to destroy us. Shacharezot Yarad Yaakov Le Mitzrayim. Okay, so that's Rashi's understanding. And it's hard to find a different Jewish understanding of this text before the days of Rashi, with the possible exception, if you say that the Septuagint is a Jewish work, and it is a Jewish work. So the Septuagint, it says, my father left Syria, my father abandoned Syria and went down to Egypt, which seems to be connected to this theme of seeing this text as being the text of land, the theme of land or no land. Rashbam, as Rabbi Kelman warned you in the beginning, I have a particular affinity for the Torah commentary of Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, Rashi's sometimes rebellious grandson. Rashbam says in his commentary here, Avi Avraham Arami Haya Oved Vegole Me Eretz Aram. My father, Abraham, was an Aramean who wandered as an exile from the land of Aram. Again, it is clear that Rashbam is understanding here the theme of this text as being land or no land. Actually, Abraham wasn't originally an inhabitant of Eretz Yisrael. He was from Aram, and he wandered as an exile from Aram. As it says, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, that's how the Abraham story begins, with God telling him, leave your land. So his land is not Eretz Yisrael. And then Rashbam says, the verbs Oved and Toweh are both used to refer to a person who has gone into exile. So it is written, I have strayed like a lost sheep. Ta'iti kese Oved. So you see, Litot with a taf and an ayin, which means to stray, is connected to the verb aleph beit dalet, and they both mean to get lost, to wander, to be, literally off the derech, off the path that you you would have thought that you would have stayed on. And Rashbam offers a couple of other proof texts. I shortened his comment here. Klomar. What's the bottom line here? Me'eretz nochriya ba'u avotenu la'aretz hazot u'netana hakadosh baruch hu lanu. We are not indigenous. We are not autochthonous here in Eretz Yisrael. But the reason that we are here is because God gave us this land. And that is the declaration that is made by the Israelite farmer who brings first fruits to the temple in Jerusalem, thanking God for the fact that we now have a land because it was given to us, despite the fact that it isn't really our ancestral land. Of course, we now, in the 21st century, we have good reason to consider it to be our ancestral land, because it has been the land of the Jewish people for more than three millennia. But originally, you know, the Torah is describing the situation of the Israelites coming to Eretz Yisrael and admitting that this land is, that something new, that this land is our land. It's our land because because God gave this land to us. So that's Rashbam's argument here, which is partially, these are the other two. I began by saying what tools are used by the people who are trying to interpret texts. Well, one of the tools I said is context. Another one is, like dictionary kind of work. Looking at that verb, ayin beit dalet, and seeing how it's used in other biblical texts, and what are the synonyms of aleph beit dalet in other biblical texts, in order to apply that understanding to our text here. Rashbam's younger contemporary, Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, offers a version of the same explanation, and he uses another tool of the pshat interpreter of the text, the interpreter who is looking for the plain meaning of the text. He uses grammar. And for those of you who don't like grammar, I apologize, but when you do biblical interpretation, you do have to get into a grammar from time to time. And Ibn Ezra begins his comment here by saying the verb oved is an intransitive verb. Just to review, I know that I sometimes have students in the university who whose eyes glaze over when I use words like transitive and intransitive. I see that some of the people here are almost as old as I am, so maybe you do know what transitive and intransitive. A transitive verb is a verb that takes a direct object. I hit the table. Hit is a transitive verb, and the object is the table. It's a verb that acts upon something. But there are verbs that are intransitive, that don't act on anything, like I stand. Although it is possible to use the verb stand in a transitive sense when you say, I can't stand that. Stand is generally an intransitive verb, but it's like smile, frown. So those are verbs that are intransitive and they don't take direct object. And wander also is an intransitive verb. You don't wander something. You wander from something. There's no direct object for wandering. And so Ibn Ezra, the grammarian, says you have to remember that Aleph Beit Dalet is an intransitive verb, which is his way of saying that the understanding of the Haggadah or of Rashi that an Aramean sought to destroy my father. Destroy is a transitive verb. And Ibn Ezra argues, well, wait a second, the verb Aleph Beit Dalet cannot be used as a transitive verb, and therefore that interpretation just doesn't work. If the Aramean in this verse were Lavan, you know, Ibn Ezra went to a Seder every year on Pesach too, so he knew this explanation of the text, but he's just saying, you can't really say, you know, that's a midrash about this verse, but it's not the plain meaning of the biblical verse. And if the verse wanted to say that an Aramean wanted to destroy my father, it could use a verb that has that same root, but it would have to use the verb ma'avid or me'abed. For you Hebrew grammar fans there, it would have had to use the hefil form or the PL form, but the kal form has to be an intransitive verb. Furthermore, Ibn Ezra says, why would the verse say, Laban tried to destroy my father, so he went down to Egypt, when Laban did not cause Jacob to go down to Egypt? So the likely explanation is that the Aramean is Jacob. It's not the Aramean is not Laban ha'Arami. It isn't Laban the Aramean, but our grandfather, Jacob, who lived there in Laban's house for many years, he became an Aramean. You notice there's a minor difference here between Rashbam and Ibn Ezra. Rashbam suggests that it was Abraham who was being referred to here. Ibn Ezra prefers saying that it's Jacob because to a certain degree, it makes it a little more smooth when you look at the verse here. Arami obeyed Avi vayered Mitzrayim. If you say it's the same person being discussed in both of those phrases, then Jacob was a wandering Aramean who went down to Egypt. In other words, Jacob lived here in Eretz Yisrael, where I am, for a certain amount of time. But he also spent a lot of time in Aram, and then he ended up going down to Egypt with all of his family. So that's the way that Ibn Ezra prefers to understand this verse on the pshat level. It's as if the verse says, when my father was in Aram, he was lost, he was wandering, he was out of place, and then he went down to Egypt, where he was worse than being out of place. He turned into a nation of slaves, and then finally this was changed, and God gave us a land that is our own land. So that's how Rashbam and Ibn Ezra offer this interpretation that, as I said, is the interpretation that is commonly accepted by scholars these days, and is significantly different from the interpretation offered offered in the Haggadah. In the 15th, 16th century, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi wrote perhaps the most famous super commentary on Rashi, a wonderful book about the dozens or perhaps as many as hundreds of super commentaries that were written on Rashi's commentary. Was written by Professor Eric Lowy, who lives around the corner from me here in Jerusalem, and used to live around the corner from me in Toronto. Mizrahi comes to the defense of the traditional understanding of the phrase in a very curious way. After he explains the after he explains how Rashi understood the text, he writes, "V'yeh oved l'fi zeh po'al yotzeh." Accordingly, oved is a transitive verb. You know, he's read Ibn Ezra. He knows that Ibn Ezra says that oved has to be read as an intransitive verb. But he says, well, actually, I disagree. I think oved is a transitive verb. It's as if Aramim Abed Avi were written. He says, there's no real significant difference between the kal form and the pl form. They're both transitive verbs. They both mean to destroy. He goes on. Ibn Ezra disputed this, claiming that oved could not be a transitive verb. Radak wrote similarly. Rabbi David Kimchi, a few years after Ibn Ezra, also a great grammarian, argued that oved had to be seen as an intransitive verb. And if it's an intransitive verb, then you can't, grammatically, you can't claim that that's the meaning of the phrase, Arami oved avi. Accordingly, they had to explain, this grammatical decision that they made forced them into a different understanding of the text. Accordingly, they had to explain that the phrase refers to Jacob, who was called an Aramean because he lived in Aram, and that Oved refers to the great difficulty of his life there. That he that's what we saw in Rashbam, that's what we saw in Ibn Ezra. And here, this is one of my favorite texts in the history of biblical interpretation. Not that I necessarily agree with Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, but it's a really interesting approach to biblical interpretation. However, our sages of blessed memory passed on their true tradition from one person to another, tracing itself back to Moses, our rabbi of blessed memory, who heard from God's mouth that the Aramean was Lavan, and that Oved is a transitive verb. I just love this scene there of Moses up on Mount Sinai, and God is giving him the Torah, and Moses is reading the Torah here, and he reads the phrase, Arami Oved Avi, and he kind of scratches his head because he's not quite sure what it means. And God says to him, Oved is a transitive verb, and Arami is a reference to Lavan. And then Moses said, oh, now I get it. And in other words, this interpretation, the interpretation that we find in the Haggadah and the interpretation offered by Rashi is the legitimate interpretation because tradition is the one that passed on this interpretation. And he claims that the tradition goes all the way back to Moses hearing this interpretation from God's mouth. As I said, there's something kind of charming about this, to say that the traditional interpretation goes all the way back to God, but it does, one might say, close the doors of interpretation. If the interpretation that you find in Rashi or something like this is the only interpretation of the text, and you know, I think we all know some people who think that the doors of interpretation have been closed, that there is one legitimate interpretation of the text, and wandering Aramean is not the legitimate interpretation of the text. And so we have to defer to the legitimate interpretation of the text. So first, Mizrahi gives what I might describe here as his Frum argument. Like speaking from a Frumkeit point of view, from a religious point of view, this is the traditional interpretation of the text. Then he goes on and he gives another argument that I wouldn't call a religious argument. It's a sort of scholarly argument. We'll see how he continues here. He now quotes Radak against Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi against, Rabbi David Kimchi said here, you have to see Ovid here as being a transitive verb. But he said, wait a second. Radak wrote a grammar book called Sefer Michlol. And in the section where he talks about grammar, he writes a little introduction here to biblical Hebrew. The situation today is because our ancestors were exiled to a land that was not theirs, and they lived among other nations, they learned those languages, and they forgot the holy language. So all we have left of classical Hebrew is the 24 books of the Mishnah and a few more words. The 24 books of the Bible, and a few more words in the Mishnah. Hebrew was a very rich language with a lot of books written in Hebrew, but only 24 books survived that were written in biblical Hebrew. And we know a few more words of Hebrew because of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is also written in Hebrew, but we have limited knowledge of the Hebrew language, is Radak's claim here, because we've been separated from the speaking of this language for so many years. We've obviously forgotten some things about the language. I had a professor once named Professor Moshe Goshen Gotstein, who was one of the world's experts on the history of the Hebrew language, and he once asked us a question in class. He said, can any of you think of the name of any individual kind of fish in the Bible? Tuna, salmon, St. Peter's fish, whatever kind of fish, Nesichat HaNilus, all kinds of, there are all sorts of kinds of fish that you can buy in Canada, that you can buy in Israel, and each one of them has a different name. We thought about it for a while, and we said, no, Professor Goshen Gotstein, we can't think of the names of any fish. And then he said, what is the significance of the fact that there are no names of any individual kinds of fish in the Bible? And students came up with all sorts of not very good explanations about why that might be a significant fact. And then he said, actually, the reason that we don't have the names of any fish in the Bible is that it didn't happen to come up. That they didn't have to say tuna. They didn't have to say we don't have the entire vocabulary of Hebrew, which is actually, this is Radak's point here, that we don't have the entire vocabulary of biblical Hebrew. And Rabbi Eliel Mizrahi is saying, Okay, we have a limited number of instances of uses of the verb aleph bet dalet in kal, and it's right. The ones that we have in the Bible that we have seen appear to be intransitive verbs, but as we know, and as I said before, there are some verbs that can be used both intransitively and transitively. So from the limited number of times that avad appears in kal, you can't say, now I know for certain that avad could never be a transitive verb. Thus he taught us that many more books, other than the 24 books of the Bible that we have, were lost. We should relate to the words of the Mishnah as equivalent to biblical Hebrew. The sages of the Mishnah received their knowledge of the language from the books that preceded them, books from before we went into exile, books that we no longer have. And the rabbis of the Mishnah, Eliyahu Mizrahi wishes to argue, they perpetuated this understanding that Arami Oved Avi, that in the phrase Arami Oved Avi, Oved is a transitive verb, and it means to destroy. And so he's using this, I think, reasonable scholarly argument to undermine what is today the common scholarly understanding of the phrase, and saying that with the rabbis in the times of the Mishnah, you know, they knew Hebrew better than we know Hebrew, and so we have to defer to their understanding of Hebrew. And if they told us that Arami Oved Avi, we saw Unklus from the days of the Mishnah, who said Lavan Arama Baala Abada Yata Abba, that Laban the Aramean sought to destroy our father. Well, that's because the reason that they wrote that is because they had better knowledge of Hebrew than we have today, and we defer to them. So, you know, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi is kind of offering two different reasons to defer to the traditional interpretation. One of them is that the interpretation may go all the way back to Mount Sinai with God explaining to Moses which verbs are transitive and which verbs are intransitive, or that we should be deferring to the rabbis in the days of the Mishnah, who probably know Hebrew better than we know Hebrew today. Okay, so to sum up to this point, I would say that there are three questions about this interpretation. An Aramean wanted to destroy my father. Question number one that we haven't dealt with yet, and we'll deal with now, is, did Lavan really want to uproot everything? Is this a reasonable thing to say about Lavan? The question that we have dealt with until now is, what do the words Arami Oved Avi really mean? And we'll say a little more about that. And question number three is it reasonable on the pshat level to read the story of Lavan and the story of Pharaoh as stories about anti-Semitism? Okay, I'll take these questions one at a time. Question number one, did Lavan really want to uproot everything? Well, it's not such a far-fetched argument, because when Jacob left Lavan's home, it says that he was chasing after Lavan, and God appeared to him and said to him, "Hishamer lacha pentadaber im Yaakov mitov adra." Beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. That attempting is the translation of JPS. The more literal translation is, don't say anything to him. Just leave him alone entirely. That God had to give specific instructions to Lavan to leave Jacob alone. And then when Lavan ignores part of this instruction from God and starts actually talking with Jacob, he says to him, "Yesh la'el yadi la'asot imachem ra. I have it in my power to do you harm." You know, you are potentially in big trouble here. Something really terrible could be. Ve'elohe avichem ema shamar elai. But, you know, the only reason I'm not doing it is because the God of your father told me last night to leave you alone. And still, he says to Yaakov, Habanot benotai, habanim banai, hatzon tzoni, v'chol asher lecha lihu. Chol asher ata ro'eh lihu. So, it's not so far-fetched to say that he is trying to uproot everything, that Jacob is trying to start up the Jewish people, and Lavan wants to take Jacob's descendants away from Jacob. Doesn't necessarily want to kill them, but he does want to kind of uproot the enterprise of the setting up of the Jewish people. So, okay, so the interpretation can fit into the text, a way of reading this text in the book of Genesis is that Laban really would have liked to stop the entire creation of the Jewish people. Question number two, what are the words Arami Oved Avi really mean? So we saw two ways of understanding them. Rashi, the Haggadah, and Mizrahi understood them in the terms of an Aramean wanted to destroy my father, also Unchlus. And on the other side, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, and Radak all argued that what the more reasonable reading of the words is that my father was a wandering Aramean. I think there's an interesting third question here. Is this really a story about anti-Semitism? I'm not going to go into this at length. Maybe this is a topic for another lecture sometime, but if anybody wants to read what I have written about this subject, here are links. I will send to Rabbi Kelman as soon as the class is over. I will send these slides, and you'll be able to access the slides on the website. And if you want to read articles that I've written about this subject, the first one is a shorter article. And if for some reason you're a glutton for punishment and you want to read the longer version, you have the longer version at the bottom of the bottom of the slide, where I'll just tell you that I try to marshal arguments saying that seeing these texts as texts about anti-Semitism is a stretch, because it's never really described that Lavan is opposed to anything Jewish in particular. And in fact, he even makes reference to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the four-letter name of God, the holy name of God, Ata, Ata, Baruch Hashem, you know, that Nichashti Vayivarcheni Hashem Biglalech. I can tell, Lavan says, that it's because of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, it's because of God. And even, I argue in these articles that also, while the Haggadah does put the story of Egypt into a framework of being saved from anti-Semitism, it's hard to find that in the biblical text itself. By the time of the composition of that prayer, V'hi sha'amda la'avoteinu, shelo echad bilvad amad aleinu l'chaloteinu, ela shebechol dor v'ador omdim aleinu l'chaloteinu, the first time you can find that prayer in a Haggadah is around 1,000 or maybe 1,100 years ago. And so there it is clear that 1,000 or 1,100 years ago, people were starting to put the story of Paro and Egypt into the framework of the history of anti-Semitism. The Jews who had been experiencing anti-Semitism for many centuries by this point also read back the idea of anti-Semitism into the story of Egypt, but that I argue in these articles that this is a reading back into the text and it's not a reading out of the text. One last thing that I'd like to say about this topic before I look at the questions. I see that a number of questions have collected in the chat. I'll look at them very soon, but I had one more thing to say about this subject. So why do we read this section at the Haggadah? As I said before, because the Mishnah says to do it. Matchil bignut u'masayim b'shevach. The person who's conducting the Seder should begin with the Jewish people's shame and should conclude with their glory. V'doresh me'arami avved avi ad shigmor kol ha'parasha kula. And the Seder leader should also expound that biblical text from the passage Arami Oved Avi until the end of that text. And we usually understand that these are two separate things here. These two lines in the Mishnah come one after another. And the first line here says that the Seder leader should begin by talking about the shame of the Jewish people and then conclude with the glory. And the Gemara offers two interpretations of what does it mean to begin with the shame and to finish with the glory. What is the shame? So the shame is that our forefathers were originally idolaters, according to Rav, and that's why we say that line at the Seder, Mitchila Uvde Avodat Gilulim Ayu Avotenu. And Shmuel says, well, actually, no. The shame is that we were once slaves. That's not something that we're all excited about, of having a background of being the descendants of slaves. And so, like, when it talks about the Seder leader beginning with the Jewish people's shame and concluding with their glory, so it could be the fact that we were idolaters, and thank God we aren't idolaters anymore, or the fact that we were slaves, and thank God that we aren't slaves anymore. I'd like to suggest another possible understanding of this Mishnah, which is that the Mishnah is saying that you begin by describing the people's shame, and you conclude with describing the glory of the Jewish people. And how do you do that? By reading that section, Arami Oved Avi, until the end of this section. That this section that says that we used to not have any land, and now we have land, that we used to be wanderers who didn't have, who didn't really have a home, and now we have a home. And I know that this is a kind of new understanding of the text, and some of you Talmudists here might not be thrilled about that possible understanding, but I'd like to present possible proof for that understanding from another Talmudic passage. Tanya Rashbi Omer, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, people should speak about their own glory only in an undertone. You want to say, I got an A+ on that. You know, you shouldn't say it really loud. If you're saying something praising of yourself, then you shouldn't say it in a loud voice. But if they're going to talk about their own shame, you can do that in a loud voice. Nothing wrong with doing that in a loud voice. And then the examples that are given by the Gemara there in Sota are, what does it mean, Shivcho b'kol namuch, speaking about your own glory in an undertone? The vidui ma'aser, recitation, also from Sefer Dvarim, the recitation that you're supposed to recite once every 3 years to say, I have done everything that God told me to do. I have given the tithe. I have given to the poor. There's this text that is called the vidui ma'aser, where you say, I have done everything, and you turn to God and you say, okay, I've done my part now. Hashkifa mima'on kodshecha min hashamayim. Look down from heaven and bless the Jewish people. That text is supposed to be recited in an undertone. However, the Bikurim recitation, Arami Oved Avi, is supposed to be recited in a loud voice. It's possible that that's even the understanding of the verb Va'anita Va'amarta Lifnei Hashem Elokecha. The Anita might mean to raise your voice. And so you see that the Gemara here is suggesting that the shame that one begins with is the shame of the fact that we were once a people that did not have any land. Although Rashi, in his explanation of this passage in Sota, comes up with a fascinatingly different understanding of what the shame here that is being referred to in Arami Oved Avi. Fasten your seatbelts. A surprising comment here of Rashi. Rashi says their own shame, Kegon Arami Oved Avi. That refers to the line Arami Oved Avi. And why is that our shame? Hainu Genuto. Shemitvadin Shavihem Lavan Ha'arami Haya Rasha. When you say that line, Arami Oved Avi, we are saying that our forefather, Lavan, the Aramean, was an evil person. Our forefather, Lavan, well, just think about it. The entire Jewish people are descended from Rachel and Leah, and Lavan was the father of Rachel and Leah. So all Jews are descendants of Lavan the Arami. And so this really surprising understanding that Rashi is giving here, that Lavan, the shame that we are reciting about when we say Arami Oved Avi is this admission that we are descendants of Lavan, and that's not something to be terribly proud of. We are all proud, with good cause, we are all proud of the fact that we are descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But let us also remember, this comment of Rashi is saying, that we are also descendants of Lavan Ha'arami, of Lavan the Aramean, and that too is our heritage. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing and open up the chat and see if we have any kinds of questions that I am able to answer. The Anita seems superfluous, Susanna, that's right. But there is, you know, if you look at a biblical Hebrew dictionary, and you find this a number of times in the Bible, Vayani yo vayomar. In the opening speech that Eov gives, it says Vayan, and some of the commentators say that what it means actually is that he raised his voice. But you're right, in the context, it doesn't make sense. I have seen there were some commentators who said probably the Kohen asked the person bringing the Bikurim, why are you here? And then you would answer and say, but I like the explanation that Va'anita means raise your voice and say this. Perhaps Aram Syria is a reference to Avram's travel from Haran, which is currently on the Syrian-Turkish border. David, I'm with you entirely. It could very well be. Isn't land versus no land really just talking about not being at home, not being in a friendly country, an immigration status, so to speak? Yes, Deb, I'm with that entirely, that you know, when the Israelites, you know, the Torah is directed to the Israelites who are entering Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, it took them a while to get used to the fact that they now have a land, and they're acknowledging the fact that they have, that they are now a people with a land. Before the Brits invented Palestine, it was Rashbam, southern Syria. Yes, Gershon, you're absolutely right. We came from Syria, and then we came to the south of Syria. And then it was the land of the Philistines earlier. Abraham goes down to Egypt. Maaseh Avot Siman Levanim. Shelley, very good point. David, apropos Maaseh Avot Siman Levanim, the flight of Jacob and his family from Laban's home and Laban's pursuit, a subsequent apprehension, is completely parallel to Pharaoh and the exodus of the children of Israel. Yes, the parallel that's being constructed by the Haggadah between Laban and Pharaoh is a legitimate parallel. Leviathan is not a fish. Agree. Yes, we tried that with Professor Goshen Goldstein, and he agreed that it was not a fish. Esther Kasher Avadti Avadti. Yes, that is an intransitive use. When I got lost, I got lost. Doesn't a transitive verb need the word et after it? You're right, Marty. It would be better. Aravi Arami Oved et Avi. But there are a number of examples. You might know that David Ben-Gurion attempted to eradicate the word et from the Hebrew language. He didn't like it. He failed. But there are enough passages in the Hebrew Bible where there is a direct object with a definite article that should, according to the grammar books, have the particle et. And particularly in poetry, it often falls out, and it's almost, Arami Oved Avi, this prayer is somewhere on the border between prose and poetry. David Eisen, Jonah was not swallowed by a big fish, and there is that pun with the word fish. Avi is pointed with a disjunctive tipha. Yes, that is very true, M.J. Frankel. If the understanding of the phrase is Avi Haya Arami Oved, then for those of you who don't follow this, I apologize, but to pick up on M.J. Frankel's question here, then it would have been appropriate for the cantillation signs to be Mapach Pashta Katon, and they aren't Mapach Pashta Katon, they're Pashta Zakef Katon, which proves that one thing that it proves is that the rabbis who put the cantillation marks into the text wish to support the interpretation that an Aramean wanted to destroy my father. Did the Midrash indeed have the trop? And I was kind of hinting. I meant that over point with Tipan, reasonable to assume. The question is the status of the interpretation of the trop in the apartment complex that I live here in Jerusalem. It's, I'm sorry to make people jealous, but, I have such wonderful neighbors here. Professor Uriel Simon, the world expert on Ibn Ezra, lives here in my apartment complex. And Professor Simcha Kogut lives here, too. And here's the authoritative book about cantillation signs and the interpretation of biblical texts. And one of the things that Professor Kogut points out in this book is that there are plenty of examples of almost every rabbi, including Rashi, sometimes interpreting against the cantillation signs. They all try to follow the cantillation signs when they can, but they don't see them as being finally determinative. Okay. Lavan was as patriarch of the family, as absolute power over his family. Roman heads of the family, yes, put their infants out to die. So, saying that he had the power to cut off the line is definitely true. Yes, noon, getting back to, yes, the Mishnah says, Achi Moret Kola Parasha Kula, then why does the Haggadah only expand the first four verses and doesn't Vayvieinu? So I tried to suggest in the beginning that maybe at one point in history they did that and that people stopped doing it once we no longer lived in Eretz Yisrael, and so to sit in Toronto and expound on the verse by Vienu El Hamakom Hazeh, God brought us to this place. He didn't bring us to Thornhill. He didn't bring us to Forest Hill. He brought us to this place. And so in most of Jewish history, when people were reciting the Haggadah, it didn't make sense for them to be saying by Vienu El Hamakom Hazeh, but I understand that there are some Israelis who have now added a midrash about that last verse to the Haggadah that they recite here. Yes, I agree. Ben Ben Melech, Dudi Kravitz, his grandfather, a man without land is nothing. Yes, okay, Brenda, you're right. We aren't all descended from Lavan, because some of us are probably descended from Bilha and Zilpa. Point well taken. They always get the short end of the stick. You are absolutely right.
Thank
wonderful
you very much.
Seeing you all. Thanks. And as Rabbi Kelman said, we're going to see if we can put together a series in May. I have to look at my calendar, Rabbi Kelman, and get back to you about that. But we'll see if we can do that. And I wish you all Chag Kasher v'Sameach, and whatever interpretation you wish to offer for Arami Oved Avi at your Seder, feel free.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. We do look forward to having you and working around with your schedule to work that out. Thank you very much. Just upcoming tonight, Rabbi Helfgott, of course, will also depart from his regular show. We're talking about Pesach Mitzrayim, Pesach Darot, Pesach Sheni, Pesach and Sefer Dvarim. The evolving nature of Pesach is presented in many different ways. That's tonight at 8:30. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., Lori Novick will be back also after a bit of an absence, emerging from the cleft of Drak Shir Hashem, which, of course, we read on Pesach. And tomorrow night, Rabbi Alan Schwartz will be giving regular Parsha Shir for Shabbos HaGadol, Parsha Tzav, and Friday morning, I'll be speaking instead of on the Siddur, on the Haggadah, things for the Seder. So that's the remainder of this week. Next week, we have Alex Israel and Yamin Goldschmidt and a few other shiurim next week too. We'll have every week, please God, I'll even give a shiur. I hope that people will come Wednesday, Erev Pesach. So we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend, Lior Moskowitz, is the other shiur. I was on Tuesday morning. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful day and a wonderful week. And we should hear good things. And Dr. Lakshin, enjoy the Seder. We look forward to being in touch and all good things. Okay. Kasher v'sameach, everybody. Bye-bye.
Kasher v'sameach to all. Bye-bye.
Kasher v'sameach.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Be well, everybody. Bye-bye.